This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. What's the opposite of confetti falling? Confetti falling upward? I don't know. The numbers are in. And voter turnout in Washington State this last election was at a record low, 37%. What's going on? We went to a vote-by-mail system to increase turnout. Here with some insight into voter psychology and hopefully some suggestions is Christopher Mann, Associate Political Science Professor at Skidmore University in New York. Welcome, Christopher.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. When our state went to vote by mail in 2012, the first election turnout was 62%. Now we're down more than 20 percentage points. Does that mean vote by mail is failing us?
I think the at least part of the story is that voter turnout has been declining everywhere. And by everywhere, I mean all across the United States, but also across other democracies around the world. So one of the tough questions to answer here is vote by mail certainly isn't making you immune to that trend. Whether the effects of vote by mail keeping people participating and raising turnout rates, it's hard to say whether it's these particular elections that we've had. Was there something special about that 2012 election? It was a presidential year, so it's going to be higher turnout than the 2017 election.
Yes.
But there certainly seems to be something going on here.
Well, let's start with people. You said people are voting less in general across democracies. Why is that?
There are lots of reasons that we see. Decline of the kind of civic organizations that historically have helped increase turnout by informing people about politics and reminding them to vote. Parties are weaker. Civic organizations are weaker. Sociologist Bob Putnam referred to this as social capital. We just have less of it. His book was famously called Bowling Alone. We don't mm-hmm. have bowling leagues, but we also don't have political parties and the kind of civic organizations that used to do voter mobilization, both formally and informally. And so we've lost that. We have less trust in government in general and less satisfaction with our government. And so people aren't participating. And one of the big things for the 2017 election, which was mostly a local election in Washington, is good folks like you in the local media. The local media has shrunk. Newsrooms have shrunk. There's less coverage. People know less about what's going on in general in politics, but in particular about our local politics. And when they don't know what's going on, they don't know what's at stake. They don't know who the players are. They don't know who the candidates are on the ballot. They don't know what measures are.
Oh, well, thank you for the pledge drive message. let's take your example, though, of bowling alone, because in a way, voting by mail is a kind of bowling alone. I remember when I used to go to the polls, and I don't do that anymore. I fill out my ballot maybe with my wife or maybe just by myself. So I ask again, is vote by mail, what does it do to voter turnout, in your opinion?
I'm going to give you a little broader base than my opinion.
Okay, yes, your expertise.
Which is, political scientists in general have found that it has modest effects, very small, but probably positive effects on turnout. And one of the reasons is exactly what you talk about, that we've lost that social component of going to the polls and seeing our neighbors. And that probably undercuts things. But on the positive side, it's a lot easier. You don't have to go between 7 a.m. and 9 p.m. We have an election here today in my area of New York. And you have to, trek on over to the gym at the school, and if you don't do it in that time period, you're out of luck. And so there's a lot of inconvenience.
Mm-hmm.
That trade-off, the convenience factor, the fact that it's an open book test, people can look up information anywhere they want, as opposed to you're out of luck if you're in the polling booth and you don't know who the candidates are. It's on balance a little bit positive, but it's not hugely positive. And it's probably not positive enough to kind of counterbalance the overall trend we're seeing among voters in the United States and elsewhere, other democracies, just becoming less interested in participating in elections.
I also find that when that ballot and voting guide are sitting on my desk, this pile of work that I should spend a lot of time on and do really thoroughly, it's easy not to get around to that, whereas voting in person was something I just got off my butt and did, for better or for worse.
Right. And one of the things we've seen with voting by mail is early on in Washington, as different counties, shifted to the system and then eventually statewide, ballots came in early in the first years of it, and now the return of the ballots is shifting closer and closer to that, that final moment on election day. So it does seem like people are procrastinating, they're waiting, they're not really doing it early in the way that they were. And so maybe that's part of it. People, you know, more people are seeing election day go by before they bother to return that ballot. And maybe we're just seeing, you know, that's that may be part of the decline, is people just aren't getting around to it in the way they didn't get around to going to vote in person.
We're talking with Skidmore University Associate Political Science Professor Christopher Mann about Washington State's recent record low voter turnout statewide and some other issues around democracy and voting as well. Professor, can I toss a listener question at you?
Absolutely.
Emmett tweets to us. We're on Twitter at KUOW, and Emmett wants to know, a Stanford researcher found that television's adoption had a negative influence on turnout in local elections. Is that true?
I'm not sure exactly what the study is. We do know that as television has shifted folks' news consumption more towards the national news, and we've seen that not just with sort of the advent of television many years ago and the advent of cable news, you know, in the 80s, but as we've seen more and more local TV coverage become provided by the national network, so there's less local coverage. We know that as that local coverage declines, participation in local elections declines, for sure.
By the way, are we assuming that the higher voter turnout is the better? Because some people think, if you don't know and you don't care, please stay home.
This is something that lots of people argue about. You know, do we want to only have informed voters? You know, I think most Americans, polls say most Americans think that voting is a right of citizenship, and we are a democracy, which means rule by the people. Demos in democracy means people in Greek. And we want to have broad participation so that people think of the government as legitimate. They have a sort of sense of ownership and buy-in in the process. Even if their candidate doesn't win, their voice was heard in the process. So generally, we think, my opinion at least, I should say, I'm not speaking for my discipline, but I think it's a good thing to have broad-based participation.
What about the newcomer effect? Because I believe I saw that Washington State has the fifth highest in-migration, the fifth highest growth of newcomers coming in, and I wonder what that does to turnout.
Well, particularly in the 2017 election, which you were pointing to, political science research would suggest that there are some problems or challenges there. People who are new to a community, they don't have the kind of ties to what's going on. They don't have the knowledge about the local issues and the local politics. Here, local could mean city or it could mean state, but they just don't have those ties, especially if they're, you know, coming from far away. And so they're less likely to vote in local elections because they don't know what's at stake and they don't know who they want to vote for. So it probably does help explain some of the decline. And my guess from what I know about Washington is a lot of those young folks are moving in. You are not Arizona or Florida or a place where most of your in-migration is retirees.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the long-standing patterns in voting is that younger people vote less than older people. So to the degree that young people are arriving and they're kind of shifting that average age lower in your electorate, we would expect turnout to go down there as well. So that's probably part of your story, both of those things, the age shift and the newcomer effect. Just being new to the community, regardless of age, are both probably helping drive down your turnout.
Why is there that voter turnout by age? Because I could picture a retiree having lots of time to vote, but I could picture an impassioned millennial enthusiast as well. Why do young people so consistently vote less?
Some of it is related to the first thing we just talked about. That is, they tend to stick around in places less long, so they have fewer ties to what's going on. And that can be their information. It can also be as simple as, do they know where the polling place is?
Mm-hmm.
Young people, as you know, had the comparison about the available time, although with mail ballots, that's less of an issue. But it's still time to complete the ballot and so forth. There's also just kind of a sense of stakeholding in the community that comes with time, that you've been there and you have a sense of an interest in the long term. anybody who's a parent can tell you, you know, as soon as you have kids, you start worrying about things you never thought about before, like the schools and public safety and are the parks good and those kinds of things. And the number of things you have a stake in as you get older, you become a homeowner, children, stake in a career and business and those kinds of things, people get more invested in the community and therefore feel more impassioned to have a say.
Okay, let's get to solutions, Professor. If, assuming we want to shore up that demos in democracy, we want to improve voter turnout, what could we do?
You know, so there's some simple things. My own research looks at ways that either election officials or civic organizations can do simple communication with voters just to remind them about Election Day, remind them, in the case of mail ballots in particular, about just how easy it is, simple as 1, 2, 3, but also reminding them, sign your ballot so that it's not invalid, you know, so it's not returned but not counted, making sure they know when the ballot has to be mailed or dropped off so that it counts. There's probably nothing more frustrating to election officials than getting a whole bunch of ballots in that they can't count because they're too late. But just from some subtle nudges and reminders to make that happen, whether it's coming from election officials or civic or political groups, do make a difference. And we think they build up over time. That is, if you remind people to vote in this election, you don't necessarily have to remind them the next one. Voting is a habit-forming kind of thing. People get used to it. They learn the process. But they also learn the rewards of being seen as a voter by their friends and neighbor, the proverbial I voted sticker. Why do people wear those? Because everybody thinks they're a good person for having done their part in our democracy.
What about a voting holiday? Vote on the weekend.
You know, there's some states that have done things like move their primaries to Saturday, and it hasn't seemed to help very much. You know, there's less conflict with work. If we made voting a holiday, we might be in a situation where more people would vote, but we might also be in a situation where people took it as a long weekend and they went off and did other things. You know, we just had Veterans Day, and how many people took that as a holiday to have some fun as opposed to honoring veterans? Unfortunately, most people didn't spend the day honoring veterans, which is the purpose of the holiday. If we had Election Day as a holiday, might increase turnout, but it's probably not a miracle solution.
We've been talking with Skidmore University Associate Political Science Professor Chris Mann about the psychology of why statistically you don't vote. Voter turnout in Washington State, anyway, this last election, a record low 37%. It's an off year. We'll see where it goes from here. Chris Mann, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And by the way, I once mailed in my ballot and got my ballot back in the mail with a little note from the state saying, you didn't sign your ballot. So I signed my ballot and turned it back in, and as far as I know, it counted. I appreciated that from Washington State. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. We'll be right back in just a moment. It's KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW. The Seahawks are hurt, but still in the playoff picture. Huskies headed to their 8th straight bowl game. They've got Penn State in the Fiesta Bowl. The Sounders are looking to become back-to-back MLS champs this weekend. But the Seattle sporting news of the week you might have missed is about this man. ...23-year-old Shohei Ohtani has been called the Japanese Babe Ruth because he's got a big bat and a 102-mile-per-hour fastball, and he might, maybe, become a Seattle Mariner. With us to talk about that, Joe Vieira, columnist for Grand Salami Magazine. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I know you have to just briefly explain Grand Salami for those who want to bring everybody along.
Yes, so if you're going to Safeco Field and you see people selling programs outside of the stadium, that is what we do.
Yeah.
Everything?
Yes. Grand Salami, the famous home run call.
Of course.
Speaking of which, so Japanese Babe Ruth, that sounds very hypey to me. How good is Shohei Ohtani?
Well, he's incredible. I mean, we haven't seen a player do both with any level of, with that level of success basically since Babe Ruth. I mean, we're talking 100 years.
Hit and pitch.
Hit and pitch. So he's what we call a two-way player. And when you are coming up through the minor leagues or you're about to be drafted, you're typically forced to choose. It's like, okay, you're either going to be a pitcher or you're going to play the field and you'll hit in the lineup.
And remind us why that is.
Well, it's very, very, very hard. We don't see it because, well, there are durability issues in play. I mean, it wears on you to pitch every fifth day, much less pitch every fifth day and then go play the field the rest of the time.
Mm-hmm. And when you're not pitching, you've got a workout regimen.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So do you think that Shohei Ohtani would pitch and hit for the Mariners? Would that be the Mariners' plan if they brought him in to try to pull that off?
I think everybody's, of all the seven teams that are still in the running for him, the plan is to at least give him the chance to do both and show whether or not he can do it. And that gives the Mariners and other teams in the American League a bit of an advantage, I would say, because you can have him pitch every fifth day and then have him play as the designated hitter. So you don't have to wear him out in the field, but he still gets the chance to play in the lineup.
Yes. So the American League, and of which Seattle is a member, that's where you have the designated hitter. That could work great for this star, Ohtani. And you mentioned Ohtani's meeting with seven teams, including Seattle. What are the odds for Seattle?
Well, gosh, I would love to say 100%. Deep down in my heart, I would say 100%. But I would probably peg it around 1 in 4, 1 in 5. What I said from the outset to people was, I'll put it at about 15% when this was everybody in the game, because Seattle has a history with Japanese players. We all remember Ichiro, Kazuhiro Sasaki. They still have Hisashi Iwakuma. And to me, at least, it would seem like that would be a draw to him to be able to say, look at these guys that have been able to make the transition. They've liked it here. And then the fact that we can, we will do whatever it takes to bend the lineup around to make him work. This roster, as it's currently built, is in a win-now position. You have Robinson Cano, who's in his 30s, Felix, and Nelson Cruz. Kyle Seager and Gene Segura are a little bit younger, but they're in their primes. But the problem is, everyone else around them, they're not good enough to win now, even with the core that they have. So to add someone like Ohtani, a 23-year-old, not only pushes them into playoff contention this year, it actually gives them someone to build around in the future, which is not something they have in the organization.
And why is this down to seven teams?
How is he
making his decision?
Well, I would compare it to a job interview in reverse. So what he did from the outset is him and his agent sent a questionnaire to all 30 teams that were like, okay, make your pitch. Like, how would you fit in the lineup? How would he train? What's the franchise mentality? What's the organizational mindset? All of these things. And from that, and whatever other preconceived notions he may have had, he narrowed it down to seven. So teams like the Yankees, for instance, Yankees are out. Red Sox are out.
Do we know why?
Well, I think everybody has different opinions as to why that is. Some people say, oh, well, he doesn't want to play in the bright lights of New York. And I don't believe that, personally. So we're down to seven, five of which are on the West Coast, including, obviously, Seattle, then Texas and Chicago. So what the belief is, at least, is that there's some relevance to him to want to play in closer proximity to home. So that gave the teams on the West Coast a leg up. But the actual list of seven teams, really run the gamut. You have teams like the Mariners that haven't made the playoffs in a while. San Diego is a rebuilding team. Dodgers are coming off a World Series. The Angels have Mike Trout, and they're trying to contend now. So you have basically run the gamut of teams and their levels of success.
Does Seattle still have Japanese ownership? Because I know they used to, at least partly.
No.
Okay. Not a factor.
Not a factor.
Okay. Do Ohtani and Ichiro have anything in common besides nationality? Ichiro was a character.
I think the thing about Ohtani right now, at least, is we don't know. We don't know much about him. We're forced to kind of make assumptions off of the fact that he had a questionnaire to send out to all of these teams to be like, okay, wow me. Tell me why I would be the right fit.
So in my mind, he's already more of a character because he has that attitude. That's what I want to believe.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see.
Okay. Speaking of Seattle Mariners not having been in the playoffs in a while, some writer for SB Nation does not like Seattle's odds to get Ohtani, writing, quote, "The Mariners? Their fans are dead inside, hollow shells of baseball fans who expect nothing from the sport because they've been disappointed too many times. Baseball has been so cruel to them that soccer is a big sport in Seattle. Can you imagine?" End quote. Is there something fair about that? Joe?
Well, you know, when I look back and I think of moments that have deadened me inside in the sports landscape, you know, I think Super Bowl 49 left me dead inside.
That was deadening.
Sonics leaving left me dead inside.
Mm-hmm.
Mediocre baseball, not so much.
Hmm.
And I think to turn it on its head a little bit, the fact that they haven't made the playoffs in almost 20 years, I would use that as a pitch to him.
The word hunger comes to mind.
I mean, think about how you or anybody else talks about 1995.
Yeah, I remember.
I was 2 years old in 1995, and I talk about 1995 with reverence.
Yes.
Like, I can recite the call that swung on and lined down the left field line,
yes.
And I think most people can.
I've told this before, but I was on a ferry boat, and everyone was listening, and when that happened, all the cars were honking on the ferry boat. We just had to commune in some way with each other. Yeah, so for us old-timers, and us who were 2 years old when it happened, there's some hunger.
And think about it. The way we talk about the players that were on that team and that team, you can show that to Ohtani and say, it's almost been that long since we've made the playoffs, because it was 18 years from inception of the franchise to the first playoff appearance. I think we would talk about the next team that makes the postseason in the same way that we talk about that team.
Okay, so finally, this player, Shohei Ohtani, is, as far as we know, is a big KOW listener and might be listening to you right now. So your pitch, Joe, to Ohtani, Japanese Babe Ruth, come to Seattle because?
Come to Seattle because there is an opportunity here for you to really make a name for yourself in a way that I don't think any other franchise quite offers you. Because we haven't made the playoffs for so long, I would look at that as an advantage in trying to get you to come here. You can pitch. You can play DH. We'll put you out in the field if we have to.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we will do whatever it takes, and you will be a building block for the future of this franchise if you so choose.
There may be a statue in it for you, 23-year-old Shohei Ohtani. That's Joe Vieira, columnist for Grand Salami Magazine. Great to talk with you about this. When are we going to know, by the way?
We will know before Christmas.
Okay, we'll know before Christmas. Thanks, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
KUOW back in a moment. I just Googled the phrase America's most famous librarian. I do those things. And the list I found starts with Ben Franklin, co-founder of our library system. Mao Zedong is on there, Golda Meir, J. Edgar Hoover, David Hume, Marcel Duchamp, and Marcel Proust. Lewis Carroll, Laura Bush. And at number 25, Seattle's Nancy Pearl, author of the Book Lust series, and now her first work of fiction, KOW's Marcy Silman. Ask Nancy what this first novel, George and Lizzie, is about.
Let me just preface that by saying that I've had, of course, as you know, we have spent like almost two decades together talking about what books are about and why people will like them. It was always easy. Talking about George and Lizzie is so hard for me, and trying to figure out what to say about it. So briefly, I think it's a character-driven novel about this young couple who really inhabit very different psychological worlds, and they're meeting and they're developing relationship, and what keeps them together and what drives them apart.
It's fair to say, I'm not giving anything away, to say they get married.
Yes.
Because that's important, too.
That is important.
Did you ever consciously decide that you were going to write a novel?
You know, I didn't. George and Lizzie came to me one night when I couldn't fall asleep, and these two characters just really came into my head almost fully formed, in the sense that I knew their names were George and Lizzie. I knew Lizzie's last name, Boltman. I knew that they met at a bowling alley in Ann Arbor, and that's all I knew about them. And that was about 7 years ago, and I just started thinking about them all the time. You know, it was like whatever else I was doing, I was living this duo life with George and Lizzie, and having Lizzie comment on what I was doing. You know, I would walk by the sorority houses on 17th, and I would think, you know, I could hear Lizzie saying, well, would my life have been any different if I had joined a sorority in college? And you know, I would eat a cookie and I would think, well, this is a cookie Lizzie would like to dunk in her tea. I mean, gradually over the next like 4 years, I really learned so much about them. And so by the time I sat down to write, I just was, it was like I was debriefing my head. It was all there. And so in many ways, I feel like I didn't make any decisions, that the decisions, you know, had all, they were real people to me.
Now, Nancy, you make it sound like that writing was so easy, but as you mentioned, I've known you for a couple of decades, and I happen to know that this was not a simple process for you.
It was not a simple process. And the reason it was not a simple process is because I'm this incredibly critical person, most critical about myself. And I would write a sentence. A sentence would be in my head that I'd thought about and rewritten in my head, and it would sound just right, you know, perfect, if I can use that word, perfect in my mind. And I would put it down, you know, I would type it into the computer, and there it would be on the screen, and that sentence would be lame. I mean, it would be nothing like the sentence in my head. And the example, the best example is once I typed, George took Lizzie's arm, and then I said, well, where did he take it? What did he, you know, what did she do with one arm? What did he do with the arm that he, you know, the extra arm? I mean, things that a reader would never, ever stop at a sentence like Lizzie, George took Lizzie's arm. So that was hard.
That sentence does not appear in the book.
No,
I read the book. I didn't see that sentence. No, I should just say, if you don't recognize her voice, I'm talking to librarian and novelist Nancy Pearl, and her new book is called George and Lizzie. Because this is about characters, George and Lizzie, and then there are some other characters, parents and friends are in this book as well. I have often heard, very often, that novelists are taking from their own lives when we're creating characters. So how much do George and Lizzie come from you, your husband, people you know?
So the novel is not autobiographical in any way, shape, or form. I do share with Lizzie, or maybe I should say Lizzie shares with me, some sort of superficial characteristics. We both love poetry. We both love the specific poets, Hausman and Larkin and Millay. And we both love football, although Lizzie has a love-hate relationship with football.
Well, in fact, that's something I did not know about you. This is a book also about football. There are many football teams in this book.
Yes, right.
And football players.
Right. But you don't have to know anything about football or be even interested in football to enjoy the book, I think. So Lizzie shares those things with me. And George is, while he's not my husband, he shares much more with my husband than Lizzie, for example, does with me. George and my husband share a kind of Buddhist philosophy about living in the present, and that everything is an opportunity for growth. And that's something that Lizzie really has trouble believing.
Because, in fact, George is an optimist and Lizzie is not an optimist.
No. I'd like to describe Lizzie as the sort of person who, if you said, is this glass half full of water or is it half empty? Lizzie would say, that glass is totally empty and you're just imagining whatever water there might be in it. That's Lizzie. I think George at one point calls her a pathological pessimist. And Lizzie in return would say, well, George is a pathological optimist.
I should also say, because I do know you, that these characters and inhabit places that you have inhabited.
Yes, they do. You know, I lived in Ann Arbor for about 7 or 8 years. That's all. I lived in Tulsa, where George is from, for a long time. But I've lived in Seattle for longer than both. But it never occurred to me that it should be set. As I said, there just was no decisions to make. It just was, well, this is the way it is.
So the long process of living with George and Lizzie and then translating all of what was in your head to a novel, how did you feel when they actually sent you this book?
Yeah, it was the whole process has just been pretty remarkable. I was so lucky to find an editor and a publisher, Touchstone, which is part of Simon & Schuster, and the editor-in-chief of Touchstone, Tara Parsons, bought the book. And she was fabulous. The book has an unconventional, slightly unconventional narrative, the way it's told.
And you have to just read it because I can't describe it. So everybody should read this book. But I should mention, as I talk about books, is that you've published several other books before this. But those are books that sort of come out of the profession and the practice of what you've done for years, which is try to get people to read.
Right.
So this is a really different thing.
It is. Interestingly enough, I often thought that the booklust books were people would say, well, you should write a memoir. But I'm never going to write a memoir. I mean, that's ridiculous. But the booklust books are really a record of my reading life. Mm-hmm. And especially the first one is so personal to me because every book in there was so meaningful and, played such an important role in my life. But George and Lizzie, I mean, that, while it's not personal in that particular way, it's utterly me. And I was fortunate enough to be able to read the audio book.
Really?
So, yes.
Oh, fine.
And so, because the narrator, who is a sort of close third-person narrator, is me. And you know, I'm sure you could hear echoes of me telling the story of George and Lizzie and their family and friends.
Well, so then this is thrilling for you. I mean, I'm looking at you.
It's thrilling and it's so scary. It's so anxiety provoking because, you know, I want people to love George and Lizzie the way that I do. Not the book, but I mean, those people, I want them to, when the last page is turned, my hope would be that people would still think about what's going to happen to them. Because there are still questions left unanswered at the end of when you turn the under 300 page.
Yes, many questions. Although it is, for me, it was a page turner. And I have to say, you mentioned this at the start or alluded to this at the start. For decades, you have come here and gone all over the world, helping readers discover books by asking them what they like to read and then helping recommend. So I'm going to turn the tables right now.
I knew it.
I recommend George and Lizzie to people who love books by Eleanor Lipman and Stephen McCauley and creators of well-developed, slightly neurotic characters who live in worlds filled with humor as well as challenge.
I absolutely. And Stephen McCauley was lovely enough to read the novel, and he loved it as well. And that meant so much to me because I adore Stephen McCauley's books. And of course, Eleanor Lipman, you and I share a great love of her novels as well.
So I picked well.
Absolutely. Marcy, go for it.
Nancy Pearl, librarian, radio personality, novelist. Yay. Her new book is called George and Lizzie. Thanks so much.
Oh, Marcy, thank you.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. If you go to public school in Washington, odds are the person at the front of the classroom is white. 9 in 10 public school teachers in our state are white, and nearly half of all students are children of color. What happens when students don't see themselves reflected in their teachers? Kristen Leung taught middle school in Bellevue for 6 years. Now she has a project where she asks students and their teachers what they have in common. She told me why that matters.
All students deserve to be able to see some part of themselves reflected in their teachers, you know? And that means our kids of color deserve to see people who look like them and who come from where they come from at the front of a class, at the front of a school, being leaders. Our LGBTQ students deserve to see adults who are living happily and professionally as LGBTQ adults. You know, especially for our queer kids, they might not have any queer adults in their lives at all, right? When we think about our students of color, like, well, they have their family to support them, right? They have their neighborhood to support them. Our queer kids might not know any queer grown-ups at all, and they might be depending on the internet to be their LGBTQ community. So it is really, really powerful to be able to say, some part of that I might want to be when I grow up, right? And to be able to say that I have role models who look like me. I have role models who are living the way I want to live some way someday. That nobody wants to be the only blank in the classroom. And that goes for teachers, too. You know, our teachers of color and our queer teachers need our support just like our students do.
So you come up with this project called Roll Call to bridge gaps between students and teachers. And what do you do? What do you do with this program?
This is my TED Ed innovation project. And so as a TED Ed innovative educator, they asked us to think about what innovations are needed in education today. And I kept coming back to these numbers, these gaps, which I found staggering, especially that race gap. And I was wondering why this was in front page news, why everyone wasn't talking about this. And so I thought that if we could see the faces of the actual students and the actual teachers that are in our classrooms, and if we could hear their stories and hear what it's like to actually be on the ground in the classroom living these numbers, that that data could become human, which I think is what's going to inspire people to care about these gaps, or at least be talking about them.
It's always great when the data becomes human.
Yes. And so I originally thought this project was going to help, you know, bridge these divides, and that this project was going to arrive at solutions, you know, at the end of this project, there we would have actionable strategies for recruiting more diverse teachers. As I started doing the project, so I interview the students and teachers and ask them two questions. One, what do you have in common with your students or teachers? And two, does it matter that students and teachers have things in common? And then I also photograph them. And I insist on that. A lot of times people will say, oh, can I just submit a picture? You know, we're so comfortable taking selfies. There's a real act of trust involved, especially now, in letting someone take your picture. You can see it in the photographs, too. There's a bit of vulnerability. There's a human behind these portraits and the stories. And so what started out as being really focused on finding solutions for more diverse teachers has really become a project that is celebrating the students and teachers we have now and celebrating the way that despite these cultural divides, which are vast, that students and teachers are working really, really hard to connect across these divides.
One of the students who took part in this project is Christina Ju. She's a junior at the International School in Bellevue, and she's here too. Christina, thanks for coming.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me today.
Why do you think it matters that students and teachers have things in common?
Well, I feel like students and teachers spend so much time at school. So it's like this huge part of our day, like 6 hours every single day, every single weekday. And they're almost like our second parents. So if we do not have any commonalities with each other, like how are we supposed to break down all the like strangeness that there already is between students and teachers, regardless of like race, gender, anything like that? When we like look up to teachers, we think like, oh, we're students and we're teachers. There's already like a barrier just by the fact that we're titled as students and teachers. And in the end, I feel like once the student and teacher creates a bond, it might not make as big of a difference, but if there already is common ground, like the student and teacher can create a bond much quicker, and that would help like so much with academics and just our overall classroom experience.
Yeah, Christina, what you say about the time students spend at school, I mean, some students spend more time at school than they do seeing their families, you know, especially our middle and high school students are at school a lot. And, you know, I was a middle school teacher for a long time. Those years, that 11, 12, 13, 14, kids are actively trying to figure out who they want to be in the world. They are looking around for examples. You know, they want examples of what it might look like to be an adult in the world someday. And they're trying it on. You know, middle school students, they sort of start the year as children. And by the time they leave at the end of eighth grade, they really are young adults. So this is a critical time period where we should be offering them many different versions of what it means to be an adult, what it means to be engaged with the world, what it means means to share about where you've come from and who you are and how you love. We should be offering them as many different examples as possible as they sift through all of their teachers and their parents and their family friends to figure out, that's what it means. That's what it means to kind of come of age. That's what I want to be someday.
Can you remember an example of how you experienced having something in common or nothing in common with a teacher? What comes to mind?
The most memorable thing that comes to mind is when I was in kindergarten, actually. I had a teacher in California, and she was bilingual, and the school like required most of the teachers to be bilingual in English and Spanish because so many of the students spoke Spanish and like no English at all. And that was the time when I like just moved from Korea, so I was also very shaky on English, and just having a teacher that was able to understand how like this language barrier affected us was super helpful to me. And
even though her dual languages were English and Spanish,
yeah,
and your
English
one language was Korean, it
yeah.
still helped you.
And another big thing was like throughout my like elementary, middle school, and high school years, like not having like an Asian teacher also made it hard for me to explain like what I wanted from education. So like to give you an example, when I went to elementary school here, I was like really looking to like challenge myself, and it's just like something like that my parents encouraged, that like my whole family encourages, and just like my culture in general, like working ahead and challenging ourselves to get a good education. And like I remember once I had parent teacher conferences, and we were talking about like, oh, like what does Christina want to do like for the next year, like what's her goals and stuff, and we like brought up like the fact that I wanted to do some more challenging like classwork, I guess, just like extra work. And my teacher kept like telling us like, oh, but like Washington has very challenging work. And I'm like, yeah, but I want to challenge myself more. And I feel like she just like didn't understand like what I meant by that. Just like, I know when I talk to other Asian adults, they understand. Like they know what I'm talking about. They know like this whole drive for like extra, like more challenge. We need to do more. It's just like a cultural thing. And my elementary school teacher was just like super confused, and I didn't really get anything out of that conference, I remember. It was kind of a dead end, because in the end she just kept telling us like, no, but Washington has really challenging work. I don't know what you're talking about. And then we're like, no, we want extra work. And she's like, why would you ever want extra work? And I was like, oh, wow. Okay, never mind, I guess.
Kristen Leung, when you were in school, what did you have in common with your teachers?
Oh, sure. So I grew up, I'm biracial. I grew up half of my school years in Honolulu, where my father is from. My father is Chinese, where there are a lot of mixed families. There are a lot of students that look like me. And then we moved to Bellevue, Washington, when I was in third grade, and grew up in the land of where my mother is from. My mother's from Seattle, and my mother is white. And back then, Bellevue was actually mostly all white, and there were definitely very few mixed race families there. And I was just at the Beverly Tatum event last night at Rainier Arts Center, and she asked the audience, what is your first race memory? And then asked people to reflect on what emotions came around that memory. And for me, I remember being in third grade, and I can recall the exact moment that my own race, my own mixed identity sort of dawned on me, which was the teacher was talking about, this was in Bellevue, Washington, the white teacher was talking about the Japanese internment camps. And as I listened, I was just horrified and went up to her in a panic and asked, like, but what would have happened to my family, right? Because my family is mixed, and my family is Chinese, Japanese, and Korean, and what would have happened? And she looked at me and I understand teachers are very busy, and she just sort of brushed me off and was like, oh, no one would even be able to tell. In other words, that she saw me as white. And I remember going back in my 8-year-old mind and thinking, but they would be able to tell about my dad. They would be able to tell about my sister, who is Chinese and Japanese. They would be able to tell about the whole rest of my family that I had just come from in Hawaii. And that was the moment that I became aware that my family was different.
Well, as it relates to our topic here of what teachers and students do and don't share, how did that affect you? That, I mean, it sounds like that teacher wasn't able to take in much of your story. I mean, did you feel that out of touch quality or that lack of something in common? And did that have any effect on you?
Well, I think it's, you know, as an 8-year-old, I think looking back, I can say it felt like just not being seen, right, for who you are and who your family is, and not being sort of acknowledged for the fear that that lesson had inspired, and just being sort of brushed off. And I think as I've spent the last year talking to students and teachers about, you know, awkward things that we're not supposed to talk about, race, gender, sexual orientation, is that people are ready to be seen for all of who they are, and that they're ready and willing to talk about who they are and where they've come from if they have a safe and supportive place to do that, and if they're not afraid of saying the wrong thing, that we really want to be seen for who we are.
That's interesting. I bet you have teachers who feel like they're, in a well-meaning way, they just don't want to focus on that minority-ness of that person.
You're sure. You know, I've heard, I've never...
You're nodding your head, Christine.
Yeah.
I've never heard a teacher of color say this, but in the last year of doing this project, I hear a lot of like well-intentioned white teachers say things like that they're colorblind or that they don't see the color in the race of their students, when the fact is being colorblind is not possible. We all see the race of each other. Children, preschoolers notice different skin colors and hair textures. Like, we're not colorblind. And Beverly Tatum, I think, says it really nicely when she says that we're not colorblind, but what we are is color silent. Right. And that we're raised to either pretend like we don't see or just to not talk about it. And I think we're ready now to acknowledge that actually none of us are colorblind, that we all see each other and that it's OK to talk about it.
What's your experience on that, Christina?
Yeah. Well, when I was in elementary school and middle school, we also, like all the teachers, tried to shy away from just talking about race or sexual orientation. Like, even in the health unit, where we're supposed to learn about it, they just, like, they want to go over it really quickly. They're just like, oh, well, anyways, there's also this other, like, sexual orientation, and okay, now let's talk about, like, puberty.
Well, would you and your friends rather teachers talked more about race, gender, and sexual orientation than they do?
Students are not scared about it. I mean, we talk about it ourselves, and we're totally fine with it. We'd probably rather have them talk about it so that we don't feel awkward talking to them when they're not comfortable talking about it. So, yeah.
Yeah. You know, teachers, it's our job to facilitate thinking and conversations and to raise really excellent questioners into the world, right? And if teachers are afraid to talk about, if there are certain topics that are just off the table for teachers to talk about in school, that doesn't stop young people from having these conversations. It just stops them from having them in school. So, if teachers are going into this profession because this is what they believe in, is facilitating thinking and growing and critical thinking, then we need to be practicing having hard conversations, because otherwise the kids are having it. They're having it online. They're having it at lunch. They're having it, you know, in whispered conversations. This is what a classroom is for, is to create a structured, safe place to explore things critically.
Christina, now that you've participated in this roll call project, has it made you think differently about the teachers you have?
I'm like consciously trying to find commonalities with my teachers. I feel like it's a little bit harder this year.
How do you do that?
I usually just try to find like a small thing that we can talk about together. So like recently I brought up like this book I was reading to my teacher. And it wasn't like a school required book, it was like an outside book, and just tried to see if she'd be interested in talking about it. And just like talk about things like dogs, just non like race or sexual identity related topics, just like normal everyday topics, just to see if like I can get in a deeper conversation with them.
You know, and doing this project, that's what I'm realizing is that I thought that as I started interviewing, I started with teachers. I started interviewing and photographing teachers. And as I started hearing their stories, you know, from our teachers of color, our white teachers, gay teachers, straight teachers, over and over, I was like, this is going to be so powerful for the students to read these stories and see how hard our teachers are working to find common ground with them. That, yes, perhaps in Washington that 90% of our teachers are white, but there are incredible white teachers who are doing the very hard work of trying to bridge that divide every day in lots of different ways. And that I was so excited for their roll call post to really kind of show the students, like, they might not look like you, but they are trying. But then when I started interviewing the students and photographing the students, I realized, like, oh, the students are reaching right back out to their teachers, too. So just like Christina says, you know, she starts talking about books she's reading or dogs. There was one little girl, she's a sixth grader, who I interviewed and photographed, and she wrote, so the first question, what do you have in common with your teachers? She begins her response by saying nothing. She was a sixth grader. I want to say she was Chinese. She was talking about how she's never had anything in common with her teachers. And then she says, but. And then she starts to list these little things. And she said that one of her teachers in elementary school had a collection of fossils on her desk. And she also likes fossils. And I was like, kind of heartbroken, but also touched that this child, this elementary school's child who was in school and didn't feel like her teachers had anything in common with her, that she was looking so much so to connect with them that she saw fossils on their desk and thought, I like fossils too, you know?
Yes, for any of our listeners who think, oh, it sounds like they're really emphasizing the differences, what you're hopefully building toward, it sounds like, is a recognition that, of course, we have more things in common. We have books and dogs and fossils and more things than not in common.
You know, I think the project, the value is not to say like, oh, look, we all have more in common than we thought. I think the value is really in showing how hard both students and teachers are trying to connect and that both want to connect. And yes, we need more diverse teachers. Kids deserve to be able to see themselves reflected in their teachers. But with the teachers we have now are an incredible group of people who have dedicated their lives to young people.
To connecting with them.
Yes. And so this project really is, I think, more so than saying, oh, you know, we're all human. Actually, I hope that this project is really a celebration of the connections that are happening despite our differences.
Kristen Leung, creator of the Roll Call Project for TED Ed. That's the education program of TED, which also brings you TED Talks. Mm-hmm. Kristen's been named a TED Ed innovator, and Christina Jude, junior at the International School in Bellevue. Thanks a lot to both of you.
Thank you so much
Thank
for having
you.
Us.
You can read the stories of more students and teachers at Kristen's project, rollcallproject.com. That's it for today. Our show is put together by Amin Al-Sadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Bon Huberman, Jason Pagano, Jeannie Yandel, and I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for listening today.